Provoki, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I sit down with my guests to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. While I have you here, I'm excited to tell you that it is that time again. Once a year, we open the doors to a special value-packed deal that is almost too good to believe. I'll wait for you here if you want to quickly hop on over to anchoredoutdoors.com to put your name down on our first to find out list. Simply look for the pop-up and then enter your email. You will hear from me this week about what is going on. While you're doing that, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what's happening in this episode. Drew Chacon has made a name for himself as one of the industry's top fly tiers, and rightfully so. The author of 15 books and a stream of impressive patterns, Drew keeps his finger on innovation, all while continuously providing education and value to his followers and readers. In this episode of Anchored, Drew and I discuss putting scent on flies, UV materials, the infamous crab, and the ingenuity that goes behind being a true groundbreaker in the fly fishing industry today. This episode of Anchored is brought to you by Brush Creek Ranch and their French Creek Sportsman's Club. Located on the historic Sanger Ranch, settled in the 1860s and known as the crown jewel of Wyoming's Platte River Valley, the long-held traditions of the outdoor sporting lifestyle continue to this day at French Creek Sportsman's Club. Born of generations of the finest sporting heritage, their ultra-secluded fly fishing and hunting paradise will far exceed any expectations. With friends or family, only 12 guests have exclusive access to the Sportsman's Club at any given time. I just got back from a trip there with a friend and our daughters, and we're already looking at next year's calendar to see when we can get back. Check them out at brushcreekranch.com.
I was born in Elmira, New York. I was raised in Watkins Glen, New York, which was, you know, a few minutes outside of Elmira, but small town, middle of nowhere, upstate New York, and the Finger Lakes, the wine region, and there wasn't a whole lot to do but hunt and fish.
It's funny, when you think of New York, most people typically think of big cities and tall buildings, but it's not at all like that throughout the entire state, is it?
Yeah, my wife is a big fan of the city, and people are like, oh, great, you're going up to New York to see Drew's family. And she's always like, yeah, it's not like New York, New York. It's like New York, you know, like the middle of nowhere. So, yeah, everybody assumes it's like Manhattan, and it's not. It's way different. It's like going back in time to Umbro shorts and the wide frame Oakleys. It's like, how did I end up in the '80s again? What happened?
I think it was one of my favorite surprises about that state was going upstate and just seeing how wide and vast it was. But do you live there now? Are you in New York now, or did you move?
No, I moved in 2003 to Fort Myers, Florida, and we spent 2 years in Scottsdale a few years back for my wife's job. But other than that, I've been here in Florida.
What brought you there? I mean, I'm going to pick through your entire timeline, but what brought
you
there?
So at the time I was working for a mortgage company, and they needed a Florida president. So they sent me down to get my licensure for mortgage title and real estate to start the conglomerate for them. And we had a difference in opinions on what my salary was promised and what it was going to be. So I said, hey, that's great. I flew back to Florida. I was working for a firm in New Jersey, and I just sent them their key in the mail and started my own companies. And from 2003 to 2007, I owned a mortgage title and real estate conglomerate and had, you know, probably 30 employees. And it was right in the heyday when the housing market in Florida was like a super boom. So I just kind of hit it right and came out of the box swinging. So it worked out great. By 2007, things were starting to come down and the writing was on the wall. So I kind of told my employees, there's a difference between quitting and quitting while you're ahead, and I'm done. Here's some places you can go hang your shingles and go work for some of my friends, but my leases were up. Everything was kind of coming to an end. So I thought it was a good time to take the money and dip out and start a new chapter. So that was it.
I had no idea. So were you fishing at that time?
Yeah. I mean, I've always been fishing. It's been my passion my whole life. Actually, I found a business card that we had to make in like sixth grade shop class where you had to like lay the type. And mine was like hunting and fishing guide. That's what I wanted to be at that age. But, you know, I'm not a guide, but for as long as I can remember, pretty much all I wanted to do was fish and hunt.
Yeah. And how did that all?
You know, my grandfather was a game warden. So, you know, and my father was big into hunting and fishing, and so was my other grandfather. So pretty much every Sunday I was getting dragged along. My older brother, you know, doing some, depended on the season, whether it was we're going to go shoot ducks or deer or, you know, pull copper or go bass fish or something. It wasn't always necessarily like little trout streams in upstate New York. It was just everything, you know. If we were down, if we were going, I was in, you know, like, we're doing red button or red bobbers and push buttons. Like, let's do it. Let's go, you know?
Okay. Talk to me about the fly tying, because I will say, I mean, you've kind of branded yourself obviously as an author, but as a fly tire, I see you as an angler, but definitely as a fly tire first, whether that's right or wrong, I don't know.
Yeah.
But how did that all start?
Again, upstate New York, not a whole lot of stuff going on, especially in the frozen months, which is like eight of them. So I would always be, you know, inside trying to find something to entertain myself. And one day I was poking around in the basement, my father's like loading room where he had like all the shotguns and all the presses and dies. And I found this like green, it was a pistachio green sewing box. And I opened it up and inside was like fur and feather and tinsel and a couple of books. I actually have the book right here. Master Fly Tying Guide by Art Fleck. And in it was my mom's notes, because my mom and dad got married at 19, and for something to do, they started taking fly tying classes. So my mom took all these handwritten notes on how to do it, like here's a red quill, and you know, so I was kind of like poking through. It's kind of funny because there's like no pictures in these books, but like you can see how she drew some and my dad drew some. And it's even funnier is this book was from my grandmother to my father in 1975. So I found this and I started poking through that, all the materials, and teaching myself how to tie. And I just got into it. And I wasn't always like super diehard on saltwater or one specific type of fly. It was more like the creativity. I was like, oh, let's just put some of the chartreuse, you know, bucktail on this hook. And my dad showed me some stuff. My first fly was a mosquito fly that he actually showed me. I have that too. It's hideous. It's like a Florida sized mosquito, like a size, I don't know, 8 hook, like, oh my God, look at that thing.
Like Jumanji. But
yeah, that's it. Like something from the Amazon. But yeah, I caught a fish on Easter Sunday. I remember my grandfather had cancer and he was in bed, and it's kind of a circuitous story, but I was just getting into it and I had tied my own fly, and I went down on the dock at my grandmother's house because everyone was up there getting around for like dinner and everything. And I caught this landlocked salmon on the fly that I tied, which at the time was like, oh my God. I mean, like, I don't know how old I was, like 11 or something. And I came up with this like bloody fish and dragged it through her house. And my grandfather, who wasn't speaking because he had like brain cancer, sat up. I mean, he didn't know anyone's name, but he was like, nice fish. And no, he hadn't spoken in a long time. And like, everyone was kind of like, what just happened? But it was enough to shock his system. And it was one of those core memories for me that was like branded. It was instantly galvanized in my brain that like, I wanted to do this. So I just kept doing it. Time flies. When I went to New Jersey, I tied stuff for stripers. When I was home, I was tying bass flies in the summer, or just kind of finding things to create. And when I got to Florida in 2003, it just kind of exploded. That's when it became really fun for me.
2003. Okay, so that was when you were still doing the whole mortgage broking thing.
Yep. So I was literally, I have pictures of me. I was a mortgage broker, and I had a real estate company and a title insurance company. So I did all three at the time. You know, I was kind of the license holder. So I had my office in the back, and when I got really annoyed or stressed out or just had enough, I would shut both doors and go back and tie flies in my office. So like I'd find, you know, like I'd just be in the middle of the day tying flies and taking my mind off things, or just it always be there, a vice on my bench, you know, just doing stuff. And the more I tied, the more people would be like, oh, that's really cool. Can you show me how to do that? And I was fishing with this buddy of mine, Joe Mahler, who is an illustrator in the fly fishing industry. And he said, man, you should really write an article. And I kind of laughed. I was like, oh my God, like barely graduated from college. Like I'm a terrible writer, you know, like, and he's like, no, like there's not a lot of people doing like how to saltwater flies. And I've never seen a fly like that. It was my disco shrimp. So he kind of dragged me kicking and screaming and said, I'll help edit it. And like, first let's do like an introduction paragraph and then explain how you're doing it. And we'll take some pictures. So that's that article, the one that fly fishing on the wall behind me with Carter Andrews on the front holding the tarpon. That was my first article I ever got published. So, and then after that, John called me and said, hey man, that's a great article. You think you could do another one? And I was like, I guess, you know, like I'm really kind of shocked. So I think I wrote one or two more articles for Fly Fishing in Salt Waters. And then I got a call from the editor of Stackpole, Jay Nichols, and said, hey, we saw these articles. Do you think you might want to do a book? And that's when it was really kind of like a jaw dropper for me, like, do a book? Like, really? And he sent over a proposal like, hey, we need 14 chapters by this day and we'll review them and see. And if we like it, then we'll make you an offer and we'll do a book together. So that's what I did. We had just had Lucy. Susan was up at night feeding Lucy and I was writing chapters of Featherbrain. And, you know, I guess the rest was history. They accepted that book, and then I just kind of got the bug, no pun intended, but I was like, let's do another one. Let's do another one. They just started banging them out.
So what year was that? The first one?
2012 it published.
Okay. So the book came after you had left your full-time job.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I left in 2007 and I did some other stuff. I did consulting for years and I, you know, was a vice president of a bank for a while, decided I really hated that. you know, I worked for Gartner for 6 months. It was a consulting firm, like a big, selling information. That was awful. I remember, they brought me in for my kind of like annual like review and they're like, so how is it working here? You know, after owning your own companies for so long. And I said, well, if you fell in the pool with a cover on and slowly suffocated, but you could see the light, that's how it feels. And they're like, so you want to quit or should we fire you? And I was like, you should probably fire me. I mean, I knew working for somebody else was never going to work again. Yeah. I'd had enough. And I like, you know, I had run three companies and 30 employees and was, you know, burn a candle at both ends and crushing. And then they're like, okay, we're going to need you to cold call today, Drew. And we're going to have this 25-year-old boss on the phone with you, making sure you're doing your talk tracks. And I was like, you know what?
I got to go.
I don't think that's going to happen. Mic drop, suckers. I'm out. Don't need it.
So what about guiding then? Did you ever think about getting into guiding?
Yeah, I had a lot of really good friends that were guides, and I watched how hard those guys grind, and it was like Groundhog's Day. It never ended. And whenever we just got on the boat and fished together as like friends, are like, man, it just sucks the soul out of you. And like, you see all these guys, it's so nice to be on the boat with somebody who can actually cast. And like, you'd hear these stories. And I kept thinking, like, I need to protect this thing I have that I love so much. Like, don't ever fall into that trap. And there's a lot of guys that are awesome at it and they're just built for it. And I knew I wasn't. So I never did it. A lot of people asked me if I would, and I did casting instruction for a long time, and I do fly tying classes. I mean, I did classes at Bass Pro with kids for years, and I really enjoyed that. But the idea of putting the pressure on myself to catch other people fish, I couldn't see how I could make it work. So no go.
I gotcha. So writing how-to articles on fly tying can be very tricky, especially if you're trying to be innovative and create something new. So what was your first big hit when it came to introducing something new to the market or to the industry?
Well, I think the disco shrimp kind of piqued people's interest. It had like a sequin on it and a popper. It was a popper, but most poppers slide. So the sequin acts like a kickboard, like when you're pool with your kids, you know, like you can splash them and they can't go forward. So it made like a big splash, and it also had a rattle. So that was kind of the first fly that checked the box for, oh, it's got a bunch of different features to it that in saltwater people weren't really doing. And then probably the other one was the Tuscan Bunny, and that, you know, just kind of punched me in the face when I was at dinner with my wife. I find these snook, and you know, they like keep me up at night, these 40-inch snook that were cruising in the river. And you know, if you got too close to them, they spooked. If you cast too far in front of them, the fly would sink to the bottom. So like, if you get, you know, closer and try to curve cast, you know, they see it in the air. So it was like this puzzle I couldn't seem to crack. I needed the fly to suspend, and so I could cast it in front of them so they didn't feel the line come down, or they didn't feel the fly, because it was a big rabbit strip fly that I was throwing, so it moved really well. But it splat. It splat like a fly swatter, you know? So I said, I got to find a way to make this fly lighter but still have the rabbit strip. But then how does it push water and suspend? So like most of them are like, oh, we'll just spin deer hair. But after a while, like it just gets kind of waterlogged and it sinks. So I was messing around with foam, but like a foam popper head is too much. And then you're trying to incrementally shave off pieces of this popper head to a shape that you can replicate over and over again, which is near impossible. So I was thinking, how do I incrementally increase the buoyancy of a fly to match the weight of the hook so that I can make it neutrally buoyant, like baffles on like a submarine, you know? So I was eating dinner at this Italian restaurant with my wife, and she was talking and saying something, and I was watching this guy put pasta through the pasta cutter, and it was coming out in these little thin fettuccine strips. And the light turned on, like, I just need to take sheet foam and run it through my pasta cutter. Like, duh, now I can take little strips of foam, and if I want 12 or 13 or 14, now I can move it up and down and incrementally adjust where it rides in the water column. And that's when I was like, oh my God, we got to go. Susan, get the check. That was kind of one of those moments where I knew I kind of stumbled onto something that hadn't been done before. And most of the other time, like when you're innovative, it's just because you're trying to solve a problem. The answer comes out. You're not trying to be innovative. It just happens. You know, like, I don't know that too many of my flies are like really groundbreaking. You know, it's like we're going to make a crab, and everybody's crab, you know, looks very similar because we all have the same palette. You know, like, here's what you can use for a shell, or here's what you use for claws. So, you know, in fly tying, I think Lefty said it best. There's only like one or two real innovative flies, and everything else is just kind of a spin-off. But coming up with new materials helps, you know, when you invent your own.
I'm Googling your disco shrimp here just to have a look at it. Where is the sequin on it? Or have the commercial tires left that out?
No, it's at the very base, right next to the eye of the hook. I have one somewhere. If you look right here, there's two sequins right at the base of the fly underneath the foam. So if it was like a foam popper, like a gurgler.
I see them.
There's two sequins that one adds a little flash when you kind of tick it along the surface. But the problem was how I got to that point is I was throwing these flies up underneath the bushes at mangrove snappers. You know, they're like a swarm of them under there, but they'll only eat under the mangroves. If it comes out, they're like, nope, we'll get eaten out there. So you have to figure out how you can make it move without sliding it too far. So I put the sequins there to slow down the strip. So when I stripped it, it would pop and it'd spray water, but it wouldn't really move because it had like its brakes on. So that's why I put the sequins there.
Yeah, that's very clever. I would never have noticed that because from the side, it's hard to see that. But it's basically instead of a bead or a pushing head or a popper head, you've got sequins.
Yeah, it's like a stopper. It's the exact opposite. You know, I wanted it to not go anywhere. And the other thing is a lot of times, like with a redfish or like a sea trout or something that like a snook will come up and suck the whole thing in, or a tarpon, you know, they have an upward facing morphology and a bucket mouth and they just kind of gulp and everything comes in with it. But like a redfish, they'll come up and kind of, they push this bow wake with their giant forehead and they just, everything just kind of skids out of the way, right? Like a gurgler or a light popper. There's nothing to keep it there. So a lot of times they miss it because it's too light and it slides. So the sequins helped with that problem too.
Yeah, I love it. Now let's talk about crabs a little bit because that's always something that gets me very curious. I feel like go ahead.
Everybody hates crabs.
But the thing is, I feel like everyone who really puts a lot of time into tying their flies is focused on trying to find the next best crab. Like if there's one thing that we're always experimenting with on the boat, it's someone's crab. Maybe that's the problem, is that it's almost always related to permit. But
they're the devil.
they don't have mouths. Convince me otherwise. But
so
yeah. Talk to me about your philosophy on crabs, because I would love to know what your biggest quip or your biggest issue has been with crabs in the past.
Well, you know, a lot of times I have these sitting on my desk, and these are little lucite molds of all the different crabs. So I can see true size and shape and, you know, you really know proportionately what you're doing, you know? So like when I do the contraband, I'd say, okay, I need this fly to look like this from underneath, not just from the top, because everybody ties them from the top, right? Well, fish don't eat from the top most of the time unless a crab's sitting on the bottom like a bonefish. So if you're tying permit flies, it's got to look like it from the bottom. So a lot of times I'll take pictures, and I have hundreds of pictures of crabs, different crabs for different areas. And, you know, and they all do different things. Like a pass crab, you know, they kind of dab. You know, they got like one crab, one little claw in and one out when they swim. And they're on the surface, and tarpon will eat those. And they've got kind of a one, you know, purple appendages at the, you know, tips of their claws. So a lot of it's, you know, the matching the hatch, just like trout guys do, but it's really more specific movements. You know, I think that everybody forgets that you can make a fly look exactly like something on the bench, but when it gets in the water, if it doesn't do the same thing or act the same way or fall at the same speed, fish know right away, especially really pressured fish or PhD fish like permit. You know, they're smart. They're, you know, just awful creatures anyways to start, you know, like you want to talk about frustration. You know, I've thrown every fly of the book at them and they're like, nah, 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 nah. You know, they seem to just know. But Once you crack the code, or you think in your mind that you've cracked the code, you actually get one to eat. Then this like mania starts, like, oh, maybe I've done something, you know, maybe I've stumbled onto something, and maybe it's this chenille, or maybe it's the 5:30 seconds and not 3:30, you know. It's just, it's that just hysteria of catching a permit, and the crab seems to be the linchpin to that.
It's so funny, because you're right, it's this total mania. And I can't tell if we all secretly love crabs, because it definitely is what a lot of us spend our time going through in the fly box, or if we actually really hate them.
I think they look cool, right? I mean, half of it is like having the bling. Like when you roll up and like, what do you got in there? And you're like, what? And you open the box, you're like, damn, what's that?
That's so,
you
know, true. Like,
the crabs look so cool. You're like, oh, yeah, bonefish fly, some sort of a gotcha. Yep, clouser. Mm-hmm, yeah. Yeah, everybody's seen that. But when you bang out something with like big purple claws, or like you use some sort of new rubber band for the legs, or, you know, like the chenille, you know, all the strong arms and things like that. Now it's just all different materials for the claws, for the strong arms. I mean, that's what drives people nuts, because they're like, oh, that might be the new thing, you know, like what do you have in there that I don't know about?
Yeah, right. I gotcha. You had said that there are four, or Lefty said that there were four main flies. What do you think they are?
I think if you go back for like the saltwater, I mean, obviously like your bait fish patterns, like your seducers and deceivers, you know, no one really ties with feathers anymore. You know, we've got so many synthetics, but like many of those old school patterns, like Lefty and like Chico's, like shrimp patterns and things like that, those guys that kind of pioneered the sport had like these very basic flies that were very similar to the materials they used in trout. They just kind of carried over. And I think that those were kind of like the bedrock for everything else. You know, maybe the first crab fly, you know, I don't know who got their arms around it, but obviously like the Bowers crab. I mean, everything for Belize is kind of like that round, green, tan, brown, you know, square leg looking thing. I mean, even, you know, a lot of the flies that I have in my box, or the stuff that I've created, is like, hey, I love this fly. This is the one that was really productive, but here's what I don't like about it, and I'm going to fix these couple of things, and now it's something different. You know, I think that's where everything stems from. And even like Lefty's deceiver. I mean, think of all the different streamer bait fish patterns that came from that.
Do you tie any of the big carbon flies?
Oh, all the time. Yeah. I do a lot more of that stuff for fun. I think I got a couple right here. I was banging around with, every once in a while I get sick of doing like the new stuff, so I'll just go back and tie some of the classics. Like this is Flip's Glades deceiver, which is like Lefty's, but you use the calf tail, which is a solid hair. So this fly will sink where the deer hair makes it suspend. But it's still nothing burger as far as weight. You can cast this thing a country mile with a 6 weight. But, you know, it's I tie that. This is a size one hook. You can catch tarpon on this, no problem. You know, but they're just classic. It's a little bit of tinsel around the body, you know, 6 feathers out the back, and a couple of snips of the old calf tail. And I mean, now half the flies that we tie, or that I tie, there's so many materials and steps. And I mean, it's a laborious process. People always ask me, how long does it take you to tie one of your flies? And it just depends what we're doing. Bonefish flies, a couple of minutes, but if someone wants you to do a crab, I mean, it's days. I mean, I'm doing production line crabs in the garage, and it's like phase one, lay out all the materials. That's 4 or 5 hours, let it dry. Phase two, do all the hook assemblies. You know, that might be 50 hook assemblies. You just tie in dumbbell eyes on a size one hook, and then you put those in a pile. And then like, after that's dry, then you get yourself a foam board like this, set all the hooks in it, and glue the first phase. And once that's dry, a day later, then you paint them all again with the t-shirt paint on the belly. It's just, there's always something else that can be done to them. You can make them to the point where like, okay, now I'm going to tip all the legs with neon paint, or it goes, the road goes on forever.
Are you selling them commercially now?
Yeah, I have a bunch of patterns with Umpqua, and I've been commercially tying for over a decade. I don't do 5,000 flies a year anymore. I'm becoming rapidly becoming an old man here. My eyeballs like want to fall out of my head by like 2 o'clock if I sit down and tie. I'm not at the stage where I'm gonna, you know, admit that I need glasses yet, but I'm just saying maybe it would be easier if there was some sort of readers or something someday.
Asking for a friend. What sort of premium?
Yeah.
What premium do you charge for people to buy it from you versus Umpqua?
I don't really know what Umpqua charges, but there's not a whole lot that comes off my bench for less than $15. You know, and most of the time, I don't even tie. Like you say, yeah, do you tie commercially? Yeah, but most of the time when I'm tying, I tie commercially for friends as gifts. So I've got some really amazing clients / great friends now that I've been tying for years. And they're like, hey, you know, can you do me a couple $1,000 worth of flies for my kids for Christmas? And I'm like, no, I cannot. But how about I give them each 3 for their stocking stuffers? And I'll make them awesome. And they don't cost anything. It's on me. I would rather do that. I don't like, if you're like, hey, Drew, will you tie me a trip for the Seychelles? I've got this amazing trip. I'd be like, yeah, sure. Here you go. And you'd say, how much do I owe you? And I'd be like, whatever. We'll figure it out. I'll meet you in Australia. Take me fishing. You know, like I just, at this stage of the game, I don't want a lot of personal orders. I got tennis games to be at and dance recitals. And, you know, I just, it takes too long. And I hate letting people down when they're like, listen, I'm leaving on blah, 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 blah. And it's a trip of a lifetime. And then their priority takes preference over your life. And I just learned a few years back as my daughter got a little bit older that I can't do that anymore.
I remember all of those days and I do not miss them. What about your books? How many books at this point have you written?
I just finished book 15.
15? So, oh my gosh.
Yeah. This is my latest one. It dropped this week. Saltwater specialty flies. I typically do species specific books and multiple. So like permit flies, then here's the sequel to that, or snook flies. And maybe it's snook on the beach. And then these are all snook for like backwater, or bonefish for Abaco, or bonefish for, you know, Andros, or location or species specific. But I found that like on all these trips I've been on, there's always this, I don't know, unsung species that's super fun to catch, but no one talks about it. Like, hey, we're bone fishing, but leave a 10 weight loaded with, you know, wire, because there's these monster cudas over here and they're awesome. You know, but like no one ever says, oh, we're just going to do a book on cuda flies. Or, you know, when you're in Louisiana, there's sheep's head everywhere. We have them here in Florida and they're fun to catch, but like you don't spend a day trying to catch sheep's head. Usually you're like snook, tarpon, redfish, you know, the big ones, bonefish, permit. So this book focuses on everything else. So it's kind of like, hey, this is a mutton snapper fly, and this is a sheep's head fly, and this is my favorite fly for sea trout, or here's one on barracuda. It's everything else that could save a day, especially if you're a guide. You know, sometimes you just got to do or catch or target whatever the sea gives you, right? Like, listen, I know you want to catch a tarpon today, April, but it ain't going to happen. You know, like over here, we can catch, you know, these until your arms fall off and we'll have a great day. But, you know, sometimes you got to convince people, and having a rod loaded up with those. I mean, so many times I wish I would have had a cuda rod or a second rod, like, oh my God, there's a tailing mutton snapper. Like, how cool would it be to catch that? You know, so that's what this book is. It's everything else.
So in your books, are they all flies that you've created, or do you ever utilize other people's flies?
No, not at all. So part of what I do is kind of chronicling the history of patterns. And I think that is more important than anything else. I have had some amazing mentors, and this is not like a sport where the cool guys are 60 or, you know, 80-year-old dudes in plaid pants doing arts and crafts, you know, like that. That's not them. They just kind of get forgotten and all their knowledge just goes into the ether. So I spend an awful lot of time finding these old timers or these patterns that I think are unique, and I interview them, and I try to really get not just like, here's the pattern, but like, let's tie it together, or show me the subtle nuances that you do that makes this pattern fish correctly. Because I know I've got little tricks that I do that make flies look great, and there's flies that fish great. And the little tricks that make flies fish great are the ones that are the first to be forgotten, because no one really passes that information along. So much of what I do with my books is, yeah, I'm going to put three or four of my bugs in there, but everything else is somebody else. And I want to not only highlight them and their pattern, but also talk a little about why they did it and what was their thought process, and has the pattern evolved, or how do you fish it, or, you know, what were the challenges that you were trying to overcome? Really get to the roots of why they developed the pattern, how they did it, and talk about the story and how it's changed and what the pattern is now versus what it used to be.
Yeah, I love that. So who in your studies so far has been, in your opinion, the most underrated fly tire?
Unequivocally, Steve Bailey. So Steve Bailey,
I'd like to use this opportunity to hear all about him.
Yeah, I hear you. Here we go. Sit down, grab a glass of wine. Steve Bailey was the guy that tied all of Lefty's flies for books. He is probably, like you said, the most underrated fly tire of all time for saltwater. I mean, when you talk about surgical accuracy, this guy measures everything with a ruler. He's the one that really took me from here to here. And I didn't know it, but he lives, when I moved here, he lived about five blocks from me. And I was, he worked at the post office for, I don't know how many, 20, 30 years or something, but he commercially tied and he guided as well. And he's just really humble and really quiet, and he does not want to be put on display, or, you know, he's not an attention guy at all. So I had to drag it out of him, but like, he willingly shared everything with me. I mean, I have hours of recordings of him where I'd say, "Hey, Steve, you mind if I record this?" And he'd tell stories about Lefty and Flip and Bob and the old days and tying flies when they, you know, invented the Clouser, which was Bob's, versus the Clouser, which is how Flip ties it. But Steve tied all Flip's flies, like when he was doing it. So I got really lucky when I was really getting into it. And so many people said, "You got to meet this guy. Like, he's the OG. And he just kind of took me under his wing and said, "You know, you're here and you're going to be here." And he passed the torch to me and was like, "I'm done. I'm going to give you this all this information." And I mean, it's, some of his stuff is just like mind blowing technical, like, okay, we're counting thread wraps and we're measuring, and, you know, every feather has to be 2 3/4 from the hook shank, or from the, you know, from the bend of the hook. I mean, he's just, his level of detail to make his proportions the way they are and completely the same on 100 flies really made me the kind of the way I am. The other one is, was my first mentor was Eric Leiser. And Eric was really big in the trout world. He wrote, I don't know how many books I have, probably 10 of them. But he came into one of the classes when I was teaching at Bass Pro when I first got started. teaching kids. And he kind of shuffled in and sat down. He was already probably in his late 70s, early 80s. And he just watched me. And he said, "Hey, you probably don't know who I am." And he dropped a book down. And it was the Bible here. His, which one was it? He has this complete book of fly tying by Eric Leiser. And he said, I brought this for you. I signed it. Let's tie flies sometime, you know. And he lived across the river from me in Cape Coral. And I would go pick him up. His wife would let him come over to the house and play for a while. And, you know, he'd teach me all kinds of crazy stuff. And he helped me get feather brain off the ground. Like a lot of the stuff in that, he was helping me become a writer. Like he was way more influential in my career with becoming an author and how to do it and how to, he would say, "I know you have a picture there, but don't look at the picture. And if I didn't have the picture, could you explain how to tie this fly, what step you're doing or what technique you're doing or how to hold the hook or what fingers to use without seeing the picture?" And that's how I started writing the step-by-steps the way I do, is because of Eric.
Oh, that's a really good point. That's super cool.
Yeah, I mean, back in those days, I mean, you look at like some of the old books and all the how-to is all illustrations. You know, they're not pictures. So he had someone draw what he was doing, and then he was a much more articulate, you know, guy, and he could just tell the story with words. He was very eloquent, real wordsmith. So he did his best to pass it on to me, but I'm still kind of a knuckle dragger when it comes to, you know, being an eloquent writer.
How old are you?
I am 43. I just turned 43 on July
3rd. You've got lots of time. What about your opinion of the most overrated fly tying material?
That's a loaded one, April.
I know.
I don't know. Overrated fly tying material. I think a lot of people put an awful lot of faith in synthetics. And I think there's a lot to be said for natural materials and the way they move and their UV reactivity and, you know, the way they shed water, and they're just lifelike. Most feathers or fur, especially like coyote, you know, it has four or five different tones. It's not just monochromatic. It's like, if you look at a coyote tail, there might be some cream in there. There's some black tips. There's some white, depending on where you cut it from. But, you know, it looks more realistic and lifelike. Where if you said, "Hey, I'm going to use a natural coyote or a synthetic coyote," like the stuff they call craft fur coyote, it's tan with a black tip. I mean, you can very easily see like, okay, this does not look natural when you compare the two. And I think that there's a lot to be said for the textural elements, whether it's the coarseness of a hair or fur versus a very uniform synthetic. So I would say synthetics are the most overrated, and I try not to use those unless there's really not another option, or they serve a very specific function. Like if you're tying a McFly foam crab and that McFly foam, when you trim it, it makes a very bulbous kind of shell, which is very hard to do with other materials. Like, yeah, that's great. You know, I can create a shape with this material. For the most part, I try to use naturals whenever possible.
Yep. Same. I gotcha. What about controversial fly? Is there a fly that you've come across over your time or throughout your time that you have realized is extremely controversial, whether it be at the time it was invented or now?
Oh yeah. It my wife laughs a lot of times when I'm writing these articles, and I'll write a how to, or, you know, I write this monthly newsletter called the Salty Fly Tying Chronicle. I'm writing number 120 right now. This is like the line of demarcation for 10 years for me. So, and every once in a while, I stumble on to a powder keg inadvertently. You know, you kick a hornet's nest where you're like, you didn't create that. That's my fly in 1974. I can prove it. You know, like, geez, here we go. You know, Crazy Charlie or, you know, I hate to even say ones now where everyone's still alive because it just tears the scab off it again. You know, like I was interviewing some kid about the strong arm crab when it first came out. And man, was that one bad when I got a call from like everybody, you know, everybody in the Keys called me at once. It's like, that's not his fly, you know, it's Nathaniel's, you know, like, okay, I didn't know, man. I mean, I got to write this newsletter. It's a monkey on my back. So, you know, you find out really quickly that there's, you know, a lot of times people come to the same conclusion at the same time in different parts of the world. And there's nothing you can do about it. You know, we're a hell of a long ways from Australia, but you and I could both see a new material that comes out like those dragon tails. Like everybody saw those coming, or, you know, this kind of rubber leg or, you know, this type of foam or something. And then everyone says, oh, I'll start experimenting with this and I'm going to make a shrimp or I'm going to make a crab. And everyone ultimately ends up at the same spot because there's only, let's say, 5 techniques you can use for this material. And there's, you know, if we're going to mix this material with this style hook or this, and you're trying to create a crab, everything's going to look pretty similar. So I just get to the point now where you're like, listen, we're all just trying to make it a better world for people catching fish, man. Like, let's just have a cocktail. Just relax.
It gets
around the bonfire.
It gets hot.
Let's talk about it.
It does. It gets hot fast. I've been there before while trying to interview people or write articles. But let's talk about people who are gone then. I don't know if you've ever read about Waddington, Richard Waddington. But you know the Waddington Shanks?
I don't. Nope.
You've never heard of the Waddington Shanks? You know when you tie you ever seen those shanks back in the day before I think Fish Skull or someone came out with shanks afterwards, but for a while there, the only shanks that you could really find were Waddington shanks. And it's from different Richard Waddington. And I can't remember if he was early 1900s or late 1800s, but books say that he was the first person to develop a 360 degree profile fly. Because obviously back then they had a lot of, feather wing, even hair wing flies. Yeah.
Yeah. Doing salmon stuff.
Yeah. Salmon stuff. And he was heavily criticized for developing a 360 degree fly, which is of course something that has been adopted and most of us use. But I didn't know if you'd ever come across something like that, that looking back now is so stupid, but at the time it was really highly frowned upon.
My favorite is the argument of when is a fly not a fly.
Yes, that's actually one of my questions for you. Okay. Yeah.
So my mentor, Eric Leiser, who was, you know, adamant about using natural materials, and he was a salmon tire, like a trout guy. So he did like all kinds of natural little stuff. But when he got into saltwater, he had some very strong opinions about what could be done and what couldn't be done. And we were at this fly tying meeting. It was like a Sanibel fly fisher meetings. And somebody was presenting and they brought up the Clouser minnow and he yelled out from the back of the room, "It's got lead on it. It's a jig. That's not a fly." And like this, like chaos ensued, like 80-year-old men yelling at each other, you know, like I was like, oh, this is fantastic. Like, I didn't know they had that much in them, but like it got heated quick, you know, but like, yeah, that when's a fly, not a fly. Like that's a lure, or that's, you know, if you mold it, you know, it's on a hook. Is that a fly? Because you're throwing a fly rod. So I don't know. again, I'm just kind of at the kumbaya place where I'm like, can't we all just get along? You know, like, yeah, but.
Do you have an opinion on it?
I don't know.
I'm very curious if you have an opinion on it. Deep down, beyond the kumbaya.
I think that everybody needs to be able to look themselves in the mirror and be happy with what they've created and how they enjoy the sport, right? So, like, for me, like, I really enjoy catching fish on the flies that I tie. And sometimes it's so pigheaded that I won't catch a fish because they're like, here, use this. And I'm like, no. Like, I need to catch it on mine. You know, and they're like, why? You know, like, we're catching them like crazy. I'm like, well, I'm kind of writing books about my flies. You know what I mean? Like, so I want to see if I can do it on one of mine. And if I can't, then I'll fix it or I'll come up with something new. But I want to do it the hard way, I guess. You know, like I could do it. One of those little kid mindset, you know, and you have 4-year-olds and you're like, come on, let me show you how to tie your shoes. And it's like an hour later, like, no, I can do it, you know. But, I don't know if there's any, I mean, I'm not down with spraying gulp on flies. Yeah, I've seen guys do that. For me, that's kind of sacrilege. But at the same time, I'm the first one that I'll smell a fly. And if I smell head cement or glue, I'll dig a hole in the sand and I'll take, you know, 6 inches deep in that mud and get that muck. And I'll put the fly in the muck and I'll squeeze it. And get it in the fibers and I'll smell it until it's gone. Cause I think permit can smell stuff like that. So what's the difference, right? Like, people argue with me that, like, well, you change the smell of the fly, but I was like, well, I use natural. Well, you know, I know a lot of guys that will be like, oh, well, I'm just going to rest this fly in the bait bucket, you know, like, okay. You know, now we're splitting hairs, right? Like, you can use mud, but I can't use dead bait, ooh. You know, like.
Well, I don't know, because that's where I draw the line is with scent as well. And I will say, though, because you could, though, get away without using a really smelly epoxy, right? You could just, your fly wouldn't last as long, but you don't necessarily have to use that stuff.
Right.
So, I don't know. I'm going to draw the line at the bait bucket, depending on how desperate I am
for
to catch fish.
For me, it's like, hey, I'm removing scent. I'm not adding scent.
Yeah.
You know, like, if I can smell something that I've done wrong, not only will I not do that again, like painted eyes or something, or if I have a client with me that's done something and like, hey, I got these custom tied flies, and you open the box and you're like, it melts your eyebrows because you can smell like the you know, the hard as hull or whatever, the Sally Hansen on them. You're like, okay, maybe we better back your commercial tire down a little bit here. But yeah, when's a fly not a fly? I don't know. If you made it and, you know, it's, you can cast it with a fly rod. I don't know. You know, it's, are you enjoying it? Are you having a good time? Okay, good. Great. You know, I'm not gonna cast any dispersions. You do you, I'll do me. Watch your own bobber. I tell my daughter all the time when she tries to tell people what to do. I tell her, watch your own bobber.
That's good. What about UV? What are your thoughts on UV? As far as if it's effective. Can you tell me a little bit about the science and your experience with it?
Oh, you're saying UV reactivity versus UV. I thought you were talking about UV glues. I was like, solar resin, the best stuff on earth.
I don't have experience with any of it. So tell me where your mind's at with it.
So UV acrylic, you know, in the last 10 years has really kind of changed the game for me. When I was really commercially tying, epoxy was the bane of my existence because you would spend this, I mean, it seemed like a month worth of your life creating this couple $1,000 selection of flies for a specific location and they're leaving on Friday kind of thing. And then the nail biting would come for me as like, okay, now I got to epoxy them all in. And dear God, I can't tell you how many times it didn't harden and it was tacky. And you were like, oh, there's no way I can tie them over again. So now I got to like get a lighter out or I got to get a heat gun and see if I can cure it. Or now I got to repaint them all with Sally or, you know, what if I hit them with UV and now they're kind of soft cured, you know, they're, you know, it's like thin ice. They're hard on the outside and gummy in the middle. So like UV acrylic, I jumped onto that train with both feet versus head cement. One, because I'm very low on brain cells as is from time flies for years with all the chemicals. So I got to save what I got left. But two, the whole process of not knowing if you've mixed the two parts right and then put them on an epoxy wheel and then they drip on the other flies or you glue two together. It's just a debacle. So the idea of being able to shoot it and have it cured immediately and have that like satisfaction of, okay, this one's fine. I was all in on that. UV reactivity on the other hand versus UV reflectivity. I also believe a lot in that too. When I wrote Featherbrain, I did an awful lot of research on, you know, can fish see in the UV spectrum? And, I think the most interesting part was this little chart here that fish can see UV color 600 times further than visible light. So especially they tested like salmon fry, and those fish that don't really have developed cones and rods and things like that in their eyes, they're seeing UV color much like an insect sees a UV reflection, like a beetle to like find a mate, or a bird that's got really bright plumage. And when you start looking at the color spectrum from light to dark, like this here shows the highest UV reactivity, or reflectivity rather, is the lighter colors. When it goes to black, there's almost no UV reflectivity. And brighter colors like chartreuse and hot pink and neon orange, those are UV reactivity because they've been dyed and they're reacting to UV light. But the feathers are actually reflecting UV light. So when you think about like all those like peacock eyes or the jungle cock eyes, where they're using those as eyes because the fish key in on the eyes of bait fish and they reflect. And I strongly believe that you know, feathers do the same thing. You know, if birds can see in that spectrum and insects, I mean, obviously we can't, but man, I can't tell you how many times you put on something old school like feathers and outfishes a super cool bait fish pattern tied out of realistic synthetic. And you're like, oh man, that looks just like a bait fish. And I put on this feathered, you know, seducer, deceiver, and smoke you every time because it just, they're seeing something else.
How did you, I love this stuff. How did you do your research for that?
For the book? You know, when I pitched Jay Nichols, I remember telling him I want it to be kind of a cross between Alton Brown's Good Eats and Bill Nye the Science Guy. Like I want to go to the scientific side of why we do flies and explain it the way Alton Brown explains cooking. You know, make it fun. I don't know if you know who Alton Brown is, but he's like, if I had a super group of dudes I could hang out with, he would be in it. He really kind of took recipes and the cooking side of things and made it understandable to people that wanted to be food geeks. You know, like here's the scientific why gluten is this, or this flour works for bread versus why you wouldn't use this high gluten flour for pasta or vice versa. You know, it's just a super deep dive, way beyond what you would think. And I remember a lot of my friends looked at the manuscript that I was going to send them and they're like, no one's going to read this, Drew. This is like way too deep. Like you have gone, people are going to think you're smoking dope all the time or something. Like this is like, people don't want to read this, but apparently they did. You know, a lot of people want to know, why did you use that feather? Why did you pick that color versus, you know, why is chartreuse good versus black? You know, black silhouettes and can be seen in the middle of the day so much better than, you know, on a dark day, you use chartreuse because it has a higher UV reactivity. It can be seen 600 times further when there's no visible light. So why am I choosing these flies for this scenario or this color water or, you know, this particular fish, you know, like walleye can see chartreuse better than any other color, or, you know, the red is the first color that disappears when you go to depth, you know, when you're scuba diving. So it just, I started to peel back the layers, I mean, you want to talk about going down the rabbit hole. I just found this, like, this piles of information on my desk that just kept getting more and more and more, and then trying to tie it in. Like, how do I now process this and tie it all together? And at the time when I wrote this, I had shut down the mortgage and I was consulting. So a lot of the process that I used, you know, it's kind of funny, was, you know, I was talking to other supply chain logistics consultants who are fishermen, and they're like, you know, it would be interesting, like, if you use like a chloropleth map or like some other tool. So like a lot of like this chart, like I had to find a hierarchy software to figure out how to say, okay, here's what a fish is eating. How do I emulate that? Like, and then how do I pick out what materials to use based on what I'm emulating for a specific movement or a specific shape or appearance? You know, where in the water column is the thing I'm trying to represent being eaten, and how do I make the fly stay there and look the way it is?
What is that chart? Would you mind showing me again?
Yeah, it's what when I first start the book, it's my, what are they eating and where are they eating it? And, it kind of talks about what you're trying to emulate and how to pick materials to do that. So if you don't have Featherbrain, I'll send you a copy. But it's one of those, like, people see this and, it's funny that the guys from Vagabond Fly took both these charts and they changed this heading to Black Woolly Booger, and all arrows just pointed to Black Woolly Booger. So they're like, yep, that's all good, Drew, but just put on the Black Woolly Booger, you know? So like, yeah, I get it. It's some people are like, okay, you know, it's a little too deep of a dive for me, but.
Do you have, what was the nerdiest or wackiest philosophy or theory that you had that you, that you either published or that you left out? Was there something that was just so crazy?
Yeah. I went way beyond, where I thought it was going to be. And I called every manufacturer. I was annoyed at the fact that, if you wanted a dumbbell eye and someone said, what size is it? And I was like, well, it depends on who makes it. Because if it's a hairline, it's a medium. If it's a Spirit River, it's a 5/32. If it's a Wapsie, it could be a micro. Or they all had different sizes and different ways of measuring. And there was no matrix that compared it all. So I called every manufacturer in the industry, and I got them all. I got every eyeball manufactured. And then I built a spreadsheet, and I got a gram scale and a micrometer, and I measured every eyeball that was manufactured. And then I put it into a spreadsheet, and I basically made them all uniform. So there was a chart where you could say, here's what a medium eye is in any manufacturer. And that was absolutely insane. Once I started and I was like 10, 12 hours in, I was like, you are a dumbass. Like, this was a terrible idea, Drew, but like, it's done. And it's really cool. I mean, these three pages of measurements, you could say, okay, I need painted black eyes, and a large is 5.5 millimeters. The actual diameter of the eye is 5.2. The actual diameter of the eye in inches is 17/83. It's a lead eye. Gram weight is 1.34 grams, which is 1/20th of an ounce, and it's manufactured by Hairline. So you could go through any one and look it up and be like, okay, and then say, go through and say, all right, so this is 1/20th of an ounce. What else is 1/20th of an ounce that I could use? Oh, here's a plain painted eye in the size medium, which is 4.8 millimeters. That's done by Wopsy.
Is that in Fenugreen?
So, yes. No, that's in my big books through Wild River Press. This is 10 years worth of my work.
Wow, what a book.
Wow,
it's huge. It's beautiful.
These three books, they're a set. It's top saltwater flies, bonefish, tarpon, and permit. And these three represent 10 years of my life.
Oh, my God.
So each one is very specific. Jim Klug donated the photos for the headers. So, I mean, it is – I told Tom Piero that I would only do it if I could do them hardcovers and I could do them spiral-bound like cookbooks because I want them to lay flat because I was so sick of all my other books having, like, mash them down or yes. put, like, the vice base on them to keep them open. So, like, all these will lay flat, and it's all, like, my photography – for the flies and step by steps, but I mean they're like coffee table books.
They're amazing. Do you sell those on your site?
These are all sold through topsaltwaterflies .com. If you go to my site, they're on there, and when you click on it, the link brings you over to that site. But Top Saltwaterflies Bonefish is kind of the first in the series, and they go. In order, bonefish, tarpon, permit being the most complicated. So there's a lot of technique in bonefish. Like if you said, okay, I'm going to start with one and you were going to read it cover to cover, one, you'd need to take a lot of naps because it's not really that riveting. But the vast majority of the, you know, the beginning, I don't know, 30 pages is mostly like how to put on weed guards. Here's a single versus a double, or, you know, how to paint lead eyes, or a lot of the stuff that just didn't fit anywhere else, like that I wanted to get out there that everybody asks about that they don't really fit in like fly tying books. But like that's, if you said, hey, I want you to teach a master class on fly tying, saltwater fly tying.
I do, by the way, I'm going to talk to you about that after, but continue. Yes.
These three books represent my master class. Like if I've talked to a lot of like schools, they're like, hey, we want to do a fly tying course. Here it is. $250. You're done with those. You can go anywhere on planet Earth, tie your own flies, catch whatever fish you want in salt water, but it's in there. And there's a ton of information. And not only from me, it's from everybody that I've been helped and encouraged by along the way that shared tips and tricks. I mean, it's the unfettered version of everything I know is in there.
I love it. I love it. Wow. You are a serious resource. You've just devoted your whole life to it.
I guess. Yeah. It's been a lot of fun. That's for sure. You know, I keep saying to myself, at what point you're like, I got nothing left to say, you know, like every month.
That's what I'm wondering. When are you going to run out of ideas?
Every month I say to myself, there's no way I'm going to be able to come up with another newsletter. When I started, I had my first newsletter had 8 followers, 2 of which were my parents. You know, and you're like, no one's going to read this crap. You know, like I wasn't a writer, and I just give away a free step-by-step every month on my website. And that's what I want, saltyflytying.com. That's what I wanted to do, is just kind of share the knowledge, because part of the reason Eric took me under his wing, he said, listen, I'll teach you everything I know, but you got to promise no secrets, share it, give it, put it out there. So that's what I've been doing. So I said, all right, fine. I'll write a newsletter and I'll do it every month. And like I said, this is month 120. I've never missed a month. From the day he said that to me, I started, and on the first, sometimes the second, depends on, you know, how bad I am trying to get it out. But I haven't missed a month yet, and this is 120, and this month will be the Bahama Mama. But I get to the point, I'm like, I think I've done them all. You know, if somebody's got to fly, please, if you're listening, call me. I'll interview you. We'll do it. Cause I mean, I am running out of ideas, and somehow magically, whether it's divine intervention or destiny or whatever, I just somehow magically stumble onto a fly in a step-by-step, or someone calls me out of the blue, or like, hey, I just did an interview with April and April's got a bonefish fly for Belize. So I'm like, here, quick. So fill in the interview questions. I'll write it up and take pictures, you know, but I don't know. I don't know when you say, you know what, like, that's enough's enough. If you can't tie flies by now, play golf. You know, like, I don't know. I guess when I stop enjoying it.
Well, that's exactly right. I'm going to go back to your website, because I was on your website before we started rolling.
Yep.
And I totally just because I was in a hurry to get to you, I X'd out of the pop-up, but I'm going to go back and I will subscribe to your newsletter for sure.
Yeah. I mean, and the archive is really, again, the last 10 years. Every month there's a step-by-step with very detailed instructions. And a lot of people are like, man, you could have tied that fly with 10 steps and you did it in 25. But like, listen, if you can do it in 10 steps, do it. But so many people can't. You know, that's the hardest part, is the frustration. When you sit down and you watch a YouTube video, like, oh, that guy makes it look really easy. And then you try to do it and it's like a cat threw up on the hook. And you're like, how did I get here? Like, where did I go wrong? And a lot of it is paying attention to the position of the materials and the thread on the vise at each stage. So I really break it down and I put way too many pictures, but like, I've been there. I have had that frustration, and I've taught kids an awful lot, and I know how fast they move on to something else. And if you want to keep them interested, they got to have 100% confidence and be successful right out of the box. It's got to work and look like what you did, because if it doesn't, they're done. They get frustrated and mad. So my books are all written, you know, with twice as many pictures as you probably need, but there's definitely no questions left out there. Like, when you read it, you're like, okay, I get it, Drew. We're moving the thread over here, you know?
Yep, I love it. All right, so where can people find you these days?
Most active on Instagram. I don't do a whole lot with Facebook anymore. I'm not on Snapchat or TikTok or anything like that. I'm kind of an old curmudgeon. I landed on Instagram, and that might be as far as I go unless something comes along or my daughter gets a little bit older when I let her have social media and she nudges me along. But I'm on Insta most of the time. I do fly tying reels. Every couple of weeks, I'll put up a bug with some ridiculous music from the 90s that I thought was cool. Yeah, so that, or saltyflytying.com is my website, where you can buy all my books there. I sell some hard to find materials. I've got some vices. I've got some free eBooks too. All the newsletters are free, obviously, but all my books are available via eBook and hardcover and paperback, with the exception of Featherbrain and Top Saltwater Flies, which are sold through other publishers that kind of handle the fulfillment and things. But all my books, you can say, hey, you know, like, I would recommend getting them on eBooks. Not only do I not have to go to the post office, but you can zoom in. You know, you can put them on your phone. You can put them on your tablet or your computer. And when you're somewhere sitting in a lodge in the middle of nowhere, Caribbean or the Bahamas or Belize or wherever, you can zoom in and say, okay, here's how you tie that fly. And they're always with you. So I put them all in a Dropbox folder. And, you know, if I were you and I was into fly tying, I would do that. And then you always have all your patterns with you all the time. I look at them a lot on the plane.
You don't need to squash them down. It's perfect.
That's it. Yeah, I got an awful lot of books behind me, but the best one is the one you got with you all the time.
Totally agree. Well, I will link all of this up. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been long overdue.
Yeah, this has been great. I really appreciate you thinking about it. Thinking about me, having me on. I'm honored.
Well, likewise. All right. I will link all this up. Stay tuned, and thank you again.